well, regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me behind the microphone today. Well, you're not behind the microphone. I am. But I'm glad you're with me for the show today. Coming up, we're going to talk with John Diederich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You know, for over a year now, John has been doing a pretty deep dive called Behind the Gun. Taking a look at some of the things we don't necessarily like to talk about. His latest piece, for example, talks about unintentional shootings in Wisconsin. What is different, though, about what John Diederich is doing is this, I think, is... This is not coming from an anti-gun standpoint. This is not a series whose agenda or which agenda is about putting more gun control laws on the books. Instead, John has talked a lot about what gun owners are doing to prevent suicides involving firearms, to do things like, you know, provide for the temporary storage of firearms when somebody needs it. And again, in his latest piece, taking a look at the disparity in prosecutions in Milwaukee and the rest of the state when it comes to unintentional shootings. It's a fascinating report. I'm looking forward to kicking off this conversation. In fact, let's get started. We'll talk with John Diederich from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel starting right now. Take a look and a listen. John, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again, sir.
Thanks for having me, Cam.
Absolutely. And, you know, I said in your intro that you've been working on this series Behind the Gun for over a year now. And one of the things that, again, I'm just constantly impressed by is your thoughtful approach to this. I read your stories because this is a multi-part series taking a look at unintentional shootings. And one of the things that really struck me from the outset, John, is that you didn't come to any sort of firm conclusions. There was no policy recommendations at the end of your piece. This really was just an exploration of an issue and a complicated issue in the state of Wisconsin. And so I just, from the outset, I just want to thank you again for your thoughtful approach to reporting on this subject, because it is, I think, very much needed and very much appreciated.
Thanks, Cam. That means a lot. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. I mean, as you write, unintentional shootings and unintentional deaths involving firearms, they're not as common as, you know, self-harm. They're not as common as, you know, death due to violent crime. But they touch us because in so many cases, we look at this and we say, OK, well, this could have been prevented, right? This could have been stopped. And one of the things that I was really surprised by was the disparity in how these cases are treated by the criminal justice system in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah. So to pick up on your first point about the rarity of it. So when I looked at this project, you know, first year, I spent a lot of time in the self-harm category, which is an underreported and larger number that people would think. In Wisconsin, 71 of 100 gun deaths are suicide. And then, you know, conversely, unintentional, sometimes called accidental or negligent deaths are 1%. That's across the whole population. For children, it's 5%, and the number gets bigger as they get younger, basically. But still not, I think people were surprised when I asked people that they guessed that this was like 25%, you know, of gun deaths. And, you know, the reason for that, it sort of makes sense. I mean, and just, I guess, I want to say this at the outset, because when I say something is rare, I'm not saying that it's unimportant. So these are rare, extremely tragic, highly preventable. So I think those three kind of points are important to keep in mind as we go into this discussion. They get a lot of publicity, and, you know, and really rightly so. When you talk about a 2 or 3 year old, that's actually the highest age category at risk for acquiring a firearm that's unsecured and hurting oneself or somebody else, right at that 3 year old range. They get a lot of publicity. So my colleagues and I in media, we write about this a lot. And when they're non-fatal too. So non-fatal shootings far outreach fatal shootings. And there's no other shooting, I would say probably other than a school shooting, that gets as much publicity as unintentionals involving children. So, you know, kind of laying that groundwork. Now, you talked about what the system responds. And in Wisconsin, what we found in our investigation was a difference and how these cases are handled by the criminal justice system. In Milwaukee County, and I should start off by saying Milwaukee County in our survey is the location for a disproportionately high number of these incidents. So frequency is higher in Milwaukee County. About 200 cases statewide over 8 years that we found, half of those Milwaukee County. And so, and disproportionately in the city of Milwaukee, and that is, while we have a big population, that's disproportionate. So the response in Milwaukee County over time has been to treat these more aggressively, more seriously, whatever the term would be. I don't mean to load that one way or another of how to land on this, but generally, if this conduct happens in Milwaukee, it's charged as a felony, regardless of the outcome, if there's an injury or a death. And outstate, there are felonies that are charged outside, and when I say outstate, outside of Milwaukee and in one of the other 71 counties, it's clear that there's a difference. Like in Milwaukee County, since 2017, there have been 54 of these prosecutions. 52 have been charged as felonies. So it's not a huge number when we think about statistics, but it is a very large percentage. And outstate, you know, again, fewer cases, more likely to be misdemeanors. And in some cases, outstate not charged at all.
Yeah. And I guess in a few cases, right, the ADA who handles these unintentional shootings in Milwaukee says that they don't charge either. But in those cases that do get charged, again, it starts out almost inevitably as a felony. And it doesn't always end up that way, right? Sometimes in plea bargains, these charges will be reduced down to misdemeanors. But what was the mindset for using the felony statute so frequently in Milwaukee? And is there evidence that this is having an impact on the number of unintentional shootings in Milwaukee?
Well, it's the motivation by Deputy District Attorney Matt Torbenson is very deliberate to charge felonies. There is a state law in Wisconsin, a child access protection law or safe storage law passed in 91 that is that says this very conduct is misdemeanor behavior. So and that is the statute that used to be charged in Milwaukee County and is still charged more often outside of Milwaukee. However, in 2017, DA Torbenson had a hand in changing state law that allowed for felony neglect, child neglect, to be charged in these kinds of cases. And so I've known Torbenson. I've been a reporter at the Journal Sentinel for like 20 years, and he's been a DA assistant and a deputy DA for about that amount of time. So we had long conversations. We've known each other for a while, and you know he said a couple of things. First of all, you know, and this is where we really wanted to, you know, be complex in terms of how we handle this, because I don't think it serves anybody to be real snappy and quick with the solutions. This is really complicated. And if you see the world from Torbenson's point of view, he sees, as he said, the autopsy photos of all these children. He handles all these cases. He sees the injuries. He handles them. And, you know, from his point over time, he said these just have to be handled more seriously as a felony. And part of that is because any one of these, as he says, could easily have been a death. So it's very serious conduct. They are preventable. And also, though, it's a deliberate effort to strip the person of their constitutional right to have a firearm, because a felony conviction will do that. And that's what he's trying to do here in this case, and that essentially your conduct has rendered you inappropriate or unqualified to have a firearm. Now, you point out that a number of these cases do not end up even with felony convictions, much less prison time and so forth. And that's because, so the majority of people who are charged are relatives of the victim, the child, most often mom or dad, and most often don't have a record. I should say there are cases where there are, you know, guys, drug dealers and being super reckless and leaving guns around children. And that's sort of been part of the spectrum of cases. But the cases, like the case of Breonna Givens that I talked about here, she's in that class of parent that I talked to that didn't have a criminal record, was keeping a gun for self-defense, was left available to a child. We can talk about that case. In the end, she pled to something less than a felony, and she didn't get prison time. So I think it's important to go through that. But there's also a lot of implications that happen to somebody who's charged with a felony, even if it settles at something less than a felony and so forth. To address your final question, are these laws effective? It's an interesting question. There's been a lot of research in the area about the effectiveness of child access protection laws, and that they, you know, save lives, they change conduct around storage and so forth. There's new research from Dr. Matthew Miller, who's at Northeastern and Harvard. He has a dual appointment, and his team questions that. They question whether there is effectively this law is changing behavior. His team found that people, first of all, are not aware of the storage laws in their state. And if they are, it is not necessarily motivating them to store differently. And, you know, really at the heart of this is this question is, are people who are keeping firearms in their home predominantly for self-defense, that's and home defense, that's what we saw in these cases, are they likely to be afraid of going to prison as opposed to be concerned for their child's safety? In other words, is the concern for a child's safety going to be the motivating factor, a sort of natural motivation? Mm-hmm. Or will it say, hey, I better lock this up because I might go to prison, whether it, you know, is good for my child or not? And, you know, in there is also a tension of like the number of parents that I talked to bought the firearm to protect their children, right? So this is... It raises a lot of issues in that, but yeah, this new research is, as Dr. Miller said, he's, you know, he told me this doesn't make me, you know, popular among some of my colleagues, because, you know, you see from his research that there is, he is working with a team, that has, raised a lot of issues around storage, around firearms in the home and things like that. This goes a little counter to some of the other research, and but he is he gave his study from 2022 is rippling out across the world right now in this question.
You know, and again, I mean, the idea that I like that question, right? What is going to be a better motivating factor? And for some people, it might be prison, right? Unfortunately, we have some parents out there who are neglectful. They don't really care as much as we would like about their own children. But I think for most parents, the idea of, well, I want to protect my kid is going to trump the idea of, well, maybe I go to prison if I don't store my firearm a particular way. And that to me suggests that education and training is really effective. And this is one of the things that you also wrote about, right? You highlighted a couple of firearm instructors there in the Milwaukee area who not only talk about this with their students, but they'll actually go out to the home and do basically an on-site inspection and help people come up with a plan on how to not just store their firearms safely, but again, a sort of a home defense plan that encompasses storage as well.
That's right. So I was at a training. This is Theron Rogers and Jagger Vance. So they are former law enforcement, they're African-American, they gear their training specifically to Black Milwaukee gun owners. I mean, they've trained thousands of gun owners in the last 5 years, most of them African-American, most women. So that's their kind of sweet spot of their students. I was at a training of theirs, and it really stopped me because they said in the training, they said the Wisconsin Department of Justice recommends that you keep your firearm unloaded, locked, and separated from the ammunition. This is the guidance. And there was a pause in the class, and then several of the students laughed and said, well, that's not why I'm here. You know, I'm here because I have, you know, a neighborhood situation that's getting out of control, or I've got a domestic violence partner in my life that is violent, and I'm not trusting that the police are going to respond or the restraining order is going to work, things of that nature. And, you know, they're not at that point saying, What they're addressing in those classes is that, okay, so you have sort of two spectrums. One, you have keeping the firearm unloaded, locked, separated, which is sort of like how you'd keep a firearm, you know, for hunting. Bring it out to sight it and then go hunting. But as I talk to people who have home defense intentions for their firearm, what they're looking for is information. And that's what Jair and Theron are providing. And they're saying, okay, so it's not a question of keep your firearm unlocked, separated, locked, or loaded on the nightstand. And some people will keep a firearm loaded on the nightstand, get that. But there are other options besides those two options. And so what they do is they come into the home, they offer this to all their students to come into the home and say, you know, let's identify what's your home defense plan. you know, who's part of it? How old are your children? Are they part of the plan? It's like, you know, it's like a fire plan or whatever. If there's a fire, here's what we're going to do. We were for Makia Williams. We were there for a tour. We wrote a piece that's on JS Online about that. And, you know, there actually had been an accidental shooting, unintentional, down the street from her that had happened just like less than a year or so before this. So she was very attuned to this, bought a firearm to because of what was going on in her neighborhood. And also wanted to bring her children into understanding firearms. So that's part of what Jair does when we saw this. He not only toured the house, and he talked a little bit about storage, and then he followed up with her with storage because she has a 3-year-old, and then she has these twin 12-year-olds. But the other thing he started doing is he said, hey, let's talk about firearms in our community, particularly in the Black community in Milwaukee, because the messaging is, you know, put the guns down, get rid of the guns. And his point, and this mother, Makia's point, was, you know, the education is happening about firearms. It's happening at the gas station. It's happening on video games. It's happening on YouTube. And so it's going to happen. So it's just a question, are we going to step into that and provide good education?
Yeah, absolutely. That to me is so key, because, and I'm going to overgeneralize a little bit here, but yeah, I think in a lot of big cities, there is this attitude that gun ownership itself should be taboo, right? And if we just don't talk about it, if we don't do anything to encourage it, in fact, if we actively discourage gun ownership, then that's enough. And so the idea that, okay, look, regardless of what you think about gun ownership, it's happening, right? And who do you want those educators to be? Do you want it to be the idiot on TikTok or Snapchat, who is, you know, exhibiting awful behavior, not just maybe in terms of gun storage, but in terms of gun handling, in terms of why they are using that firearm? Or do you want to have credible messengers who can, again, talk about ways to safely and responsibly exercise your Second Amendment rights? And I you know, obviously I fall firmly on the line of let's get those credible messengers out there. But again, I just, you know, I was so impressed by not just what these folks had to say, but the fact that you actually found and wanted to talk to these voices and these individuals. So again, I just want to thank you for that, John. So where are you going next with this series and with your stories here?
Well, I appreciate that again. I feel like what I've been sort of brought into here is just a rich world of different perspectives on firearms. And this particular piece is really touching a nerve among people in Milwaukee, and particularly as I'm making appearances around Milwaukee. And I'm happy to be here with your audience, is particularly among Black radio stations. And that in Milwaukee has been an interesting conversation. We're talking right now about an event or a series of events in the Milwaukee area, talking about, like we did in Wausau, but that was in Wausau, Wisconsin. That was in northern Wisconsin. We went into an area there to talk about mental health at the intersection of mental health and firearms, which we talked about back in May of this year. What this would be something that akin to that, a little bit like firearms. The talking point might be firearms owners talking to firearms owners about storage. And you know, again, not saying get a gun, don't get a gun. That's sort of a different discussion. But if you do, here's what to think about. And here's what to think about in terms of the technology. I spoke to Timmy O, who founded VeriSafe for this project. He actually started VeriSafe because of one of these cases. And so it's very interesting to me to see what's happening with technology. And so this event would be sort of delving into it. It would also delve into this and really sort of highlight this area of what's up with these cable locks. Like, everyone's saying like these cable locks are going to solve the problem. I mean, they're not. I mean, some people use them, yes, I suppose, but they're not really a practical solution. And as I was on these radio shows, people are just like, I'm just not going to use them. And if that's the messaging that's pushed out, then you're not giving people a place to go. And so so actually providing solutions that meet people where they're at. And then, like I said, there is a number of other cases that, you know, I'm talking to a lot of moms. You know, I mentioned Brianna Givens at the beginning, you know, she's had her whole life has been turned upside down. I mean, it's a terrible situation. Her son shot himself in the hand with a gun that was left under a mattress. The reason she was there, she had been threatened. She had had a gun put to her head weeks earlier. And but at the end of the story, she's lost a lot because of that case. She ended up getting probation and a misdemeanor, but because it's a neglect misdemeanor, she can't be a nurse anymore. So, you know, those kinds of cases keep coming up. I'm going to follow this thread for a while. And I will say there's more ideas that I have about from this project. It's a real gift that I've been led into this and earned the trust of Jair and Tehran and you know, and all the others. It's a real value that I'm able to be invited into these conversations. So I just feel like that's a real sacred duty, and I'm, you know, going to continue on with that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, John. And of course, we are always looking forward to having you back on the show to talk about what you have found in your reporting. So again, thank you again for what you're doing. I really appreciate it. And I'm really glad you could join us on the program today.
Thanks, Kim. My pleasure.
My thanks to John for coming on the program. Looking forward to talking to him again very soon. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with the story of Washington State. Kent man sentenced in straw purchase case involving dozens of guns linked to crime. More than 133 firearms, according to KOMO in Seattle, Washington. 33-year-old Dion Cooper pleaded guilty to multiple federal firearms charges, including trafficking in firearms, making a false statement in connection with the acquisition of firearms and straw purchasing firearms. The assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted Cooper said that he was the largest known straw purchaser in the history of the Western District of Washington. He said, "We have too many guns on the street. And because of Dion Cooper, there are 133 extra guns on the street being used in crime. That," he says, "is adding fuel to the fire that our community is already dealing with." Now, first of all, Todd Greenberg, we don't have too many guns on the street. As far as I'm concerned, until every American is lawfully exercising their Second Amendment rights, we won't have too many guns on the street. What we have here is somebody, again, who's illegally supplying guns to criminals. And under federal law, each one of these violations would be punishable by up to 10 years in prison. So how much time did Dion Cooper get after pleading guilty to straw buying, again, about 133 firearms between 2021 and 2023? According to Greenberg, 54 of the guns that he purchased were linked in and used in violent crimes. He says this wasn't theoretical at all. These guns caused immense harm in our community. So why? Why was Cooper sentenced to just 3 years behind bars? When, again, one of these charges could have resulted in a 10-year prison sentence. This is unbelievable. His attorney had asked for a sentence of only probation, saying in a sentencing memo that mass incarceration has not worked to stop gun violence in the United States. And the prosecutor, I guess, objected to that. But the judge, again, just 3 years behind bars. And he is able to voluntarily surrender himself into custody in February. So he'll still be home for Christmas and to ring in the new year. How about that? Yeah. So much for getting tough on violent offenders under the Biden administration, right? And today's Armed Citizen story from Ohio, where police say an intruder was shot and killed by a resident during a balcony break-in in Westchester Township. Happened early Sunday morning. Police say they found that a man who lived in one of the apartments had heard noises on his balcony and then found and shot a man who had broken into his home. The intruder, not yet identified, taken to a hospital with a life-threatening injuries. Police later said that he died due to his injuries. The resident being cooperative, the shooting is still under investigation. And again, if the resident was where he had every right to be and the intruder did not have a right to be in that apartment, then I would say this is a pretty clear-cut case of self-defense. But we'll keep our eyes open for any more details as they become available. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A stranger in Michigan who saved a man's life after the man's car went off of an icy road and into water. Dom Myers had just moved to Michigan from Indiana in March of this year, and he had finished his first day at work. He was heading home, and all of a sudden, he said it was so crazy because the ice like grabbed my tire and just pulled it. It took two blinks, and I was over. I was in the water. His minivan hit a patch of black ice, plunging into a pond. Now, he called 911. He punctured the windshield. But ultimately, that led to more cold water coming in, and he had nothing to break the car window. The door was shut. He ended up hanging up on dispatchers and calling his wife so he could, says he could hear her voice one more time. He said, I didn't think I was going to make it. But he said as the water was rising and he was preparing to die, he said an arm reached through into the freezing water and pulled him to safety. He said 90% of people will just go by, not even stop. So for somebody to jump into the cold, frozen water, he said, that was awesome. By the time paramedics arrived and started treating him for hypothermia, his body temperature had dropped to 83 degrees. He was placed in a forced warming air system to stabilize his condition. The stranger, by the way, Nicholas Kolb, was actually one of Meyer's coworkers. He hadn't met him yet because, again, this was the first day on the job. But Kolb saw the car in the water, saw the light still on, heard the screams from his coworker. And he said, as soon as I heard his voice, I didn't think. I just leaped right in. He said he is grateful that Myers is safe and home with his family. He says there's not much more price I can pay for somebody who saved my life. That's Mr. Myers. He said, no matter what I give or do, there is nothing that I can do for that. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Nicholas Kolb, there in the great state of Michigan, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Just a quick TMI update on Missy. She went back into the hospital, unfortunately, on Friday. She is still there today. Probably going to be there at least through tomorrow. The good news, if you are the praying kind, your prayers, I think, are being answered. She is improved from where she was on Friday. But once again, my schedule is going to be a little bit hectic. We are going to be talking with Diana Muller on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I'm not sure how much writing I'll be able to do for BearingArms.com, but Tom Knighton has this covered as well. So be sure to check out the website for all the latest Second Amendment news and information. We'll see you back here for another Cam and Company tomorrow. We've got another episode on tap for Wednesday as well. So I will do my best. Even if I have to record this at like 12:30 at night, we'll get a show up. But I'm not sure how much writing I'm going to be able to do over the next couple of days. But again, thank you so much for your thoughts and your prayers. They are greatly appreciated. And hopefully we'll have some good news to share about Missy here in the next couple of days. But until then, we will, we'll keep fighting. And we'll see you here soon. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.